Hello everyone, my name is Michael Petter and I am your speaker for this lecture. Last time you had my assistant read the first part of the lecture about the foundations of memory models, starting with strict consistency and defining sequential consistency, as well as the happened before relation, the happened before diagrams. So this was kind of very restrictive idea of how a machine would actually work. So the machine model was very, very tight in terms of dimensions that the hardware manufacturers could optimize accesses to memory. And since access to memory is usually the bottleneck for computations in your machine, this is something which was not desired by the hardware manufacturers. So the idea was then to come up with clever ways to speed up computation, and one of those was to give different cores the possibility to keep an own private copy of the common memory called cache, and to work on this, because the cache would be connected to the core with a very high access speed. So people who have a little bit of a background in databases react highly allergic to redundant data store. You get all kinds of problems if you replicate your data, so why should it be different in that case? And clearly it isn't. If you replicate your data throughout your cores, you'll run out of sync at some point, for sure, if you start writing to your data. So what can you do to circumvent that? And the idea for that was to introduce a particular protocol to take care of the fraction of memory that you see, and that it remains actually up to date with all the other cores. So this is the so-called MESI protocol. And the MESI protocol works in the sense that you keep fractions of your memory, so-called cache line, in your local cache. And this cache line contains, of course, the actual data of the memory fragment that you represent with that, but also you take care of the current state of the cache line, in the sense that some kind of summary of what you have so far done or seen for that particular address fraction. And these particular states are these M, E, S, and I. That's the name MESI, and this is short for modified, exclusive, shared, and invalid. So these are states that each of the cache lines can take, and they can transition from one state to another depending on what the actual events are that the processors see happening with respect to the addresses that correspond to these cache lines. So there is transitions between those states for each of these cache lines separately. So you have to track the current state for each of these cache lines. So what are the respective states? So there is this invalid state, or for short I, which means that this cache line is either has never been, or this slot in your cache has never been used so far, or you've decided to lose interest in the in some particular address earlier on and consider this slot as outdated and don't care anymore what's in there. So in these cases, it's invalid and can be reused. Then there's the state shared, which means that you keep actual data in your slot in the cache, and consider the possibility that the data that you have stored in there is replicated throughout your network of processors somewhere else, thus can be shared. It is not necessarily like that, because you don't you actually usually don't realize that your peer somewhere else, some other processor, drops interest in a certain cache line, so you don't really realize when they discard information there, so you won't notice that you're the only one interested in that cache line anymore. But still, you would keep this cache line as potentially shared. So this is the S state, and then there's E, the exclusive state, and this is a state that is not usually very you won't be able to keep your cache line in exclusive state for long in most cases. This usually means that the cache line is an exact replica of the address space associated with it in the main memory, and no one else has a copy of that. So this usually happens whenever you you start requesting a particular cache line, and none of the other of the other processors is able to respond to your request. Instead, the main memory gives it to you. In those cases, you can assume that the content is exclusive to just you. So this is exclusive, and then there's the modified version. This is attack for a cache line where you have already performed modifications, and the modifications have not been committed to main memory yet. So usually what happens in these cases is that you are the only one actually having a particular cache line in your cache, and you have already done modifications on that. So it's kind of an exclusive thing without the property that it isn't the exactly same as the memory. So in these in this state, you usually have to at some point inform the main memory about what you've done there. Yes, please. So the question is, can you transition from M to S? And well, it's already indicated on the slides, and yes, you can. However, you have to inform the main memory about your modifications so that he can, or well, it can keep track of that, and usually do that by responding to your peer's request with not the usual read response, but with something different, particularly a write back. And yeah, with that, you can go from modified to shared immediately. Good. Yeah, so this is kind of the overview on the actual states. What you should keep in mind is those are meant for one cache line only, and each of the cache lines have their own state, and they might be completely different. You just don't know directly from one cache line what the other value would be. So, the global state of the whole system is kept consistent by sending messages from one actor in the system to the other, which would be like processors in most cases. So you can send messages from one to the other. They are communicated with a common bus. Also, the main memory is connected to this bus and might interfere in your communication by giving certain answers. If, for example, there is no answer from other caches, then the main memory might jump in. And also, with this communicating bus, you get kind of a linearization of messages. So you can't have two messages at the same time. Instead, the bus system will enforce that messages are always happening in a sequence, and then that there is a clear a clear order between the messages happening there. And if two participants in communication decide to act at, well, a somewhat same point in time, then the bus system sorts it out and gives one of the participants priority. By whatever means the hardware provides, we don't actually really care. The only result that we get is that there's no two messages at the same time, that but there's a clear order in them. So, what are the typical messages that happen in there? So, these messages have different types, and they are used to coordinate the different participants of communication. So, usually the different processes and the caches. And, well, what are the typical requests that are exchanged? There's for, well, before we dive deeper into that, maybe let's connect that with the diagram that we had so far. So this is the diagram of the state changing. So one of the transitions in there usually is related to a message being registered by the actor in that sense. But these messages are not only relevant to this particular cache locally, but they communicate with other caches. So they will trigger some kind of, or possibly trigger some kind of state change in some other participant also. So these are not only locally relevant for changing states, but also trigger a change in some other cache. So what can happen? Usually there is at some point the need for input data. So usually at some point there will be a load issued from one of the programs that is run, and this usually results in a read message should your processor not have the particular address already covered in its cache. In that case, we would call the situation a cache miss. And in case of such a cache miss, we have to send out a read request. So this is a read request, and one of the CPUs is the source of that, and it broadcasts on the bus and waits for whatever kind of response it will get. And the response for that is the so-called read response. Usually, other processors, whenever they have the cache line containing the address in question, will issue a read response. It will have one of these cache lines in its cache when this address is associated with either shared state or exclusive state. So in those cases, usually you can respond with a read response, and it will come from the processor that has the cache line and will be addressed at the processor that issued the read request. And we can answer with a read response if you have the cache line in shared or exclusive state. If you are already in shared state, this will not change your current state. If you are in exclusive state, well, then you have the event that someone else is interested in the same cache line as you, so you will switch to shared state then. So this is one of the state transitions that we have talked about, and this will be something like going from E to S. So, well, this one. Then there's the invalidate message. So this is a thing that is usually coming from a processor in the case that it wants to modify a cache line that it already has in possession, particularly if this cache line is shared between other processors. Remember that you you know whether this cache line is shared or potentially shared with other processors. From this, you can directly read it from the state. Particularly if you are in shared state, you know you will have to notice others about your intent to write to that thing. So usually, what you do is you will issue an invalidate message. So you yourself will not directly change your state as a result of just an invalidate message being issued, because, well, others still need to acknowledge that you are allowed to change that. That might be, well, there might be races on the right to change a particular cache line, so you will not immediately be able to start modifying your cache line. The other thing is, from a perspective of someone who has a cache line in shared state already, and that you see that on the bus there's an invalidate request on a particular cache line, you will usually respond with an invalidate acknowledgement and drop information about that cache line by setting that cache line to invalid. So that is the usual reaction to that. If you are a processor that doesn't have any doesn't have that particular cache line that needed to be invalidated, well, you can just acknowledge that anyway. The original sender of the invalidation request will not continue until it has received invalidation acknowledgements from all the participants of the processor collection. So if you have four cores in your system, then you will wait for three invalidation acknowledgements before you can continue with your computation. So upon receiving the third invalidation acknowledgement, you will change from shared to exclusive, because in that state, then everyone will have evicted the other cache line. So you are exclusive user of that, and you can then start modifying that. There's also the case of a combined read request and invalidate request. So this is usually issued if you encounter something like, for example, an increment operator or something, which will for which you don't have the cache line yet. So you, what you do is you request the current cache line with the intent to immediately start writing into that. So that is something for which there's an abbreviation. Instead of sending two separate messages, you can send a combined one. Then there's the particular form of read response called the write back, which is usually, well, it has two uses. For once, you can issue that whenever a read request for a cache line that you have in modified state is issued. If you observe something like that, then you may answer to, or you will probably answer to that read response, because you are the one who has the most recent version of that cache line at the moment. You have modified it, and modified is always kind of an exclusive thing. However, you can't simply share it with the others by transitioning to shared state, because in that case you would lose the information that the version of the cache line is out of sync with the main memory. At some point you might consider to lose interest in that particular address space and drop it if it's just in shared state, and then your update to the main memory gets lost. So what do you do in that case? You don't respond with a read response, but instead you answer with a write back. So the main memory that also listens to the communication bus will snoop in and check that that there's a write back message coming from one core, which will probably have modified that particular cache line and will take this modification into its own whatever it has, store buffer, or directly modify its content. However, it will anyway it will incorporate this change into its own view on the data, and from that point on the data would also answer with this updated value to any request. So in that sense the value or the address is now in sync with memory again, so you don't need to keep it with this dirty flag modified, but instead you can switch back to in sync with memory. So it would conceptually first go to exclusive, and then you immediately share it with your with the one that you send the message to. So you will immediately go to shared state then. So that is the use of write back. For once, and the other use is at some point you might lose interest in that particular cache line. You haven't hit that cache line for a long time, and you need you're in need of space for other computations. So you will decide to drop that particular cache line, and since it's still in a modified state, you will have to inform the main memory about changes that you have done and not committed so far to main memory. So you will, out of the blue, issue a write-back message, thus informing the main memory about the updated data, and then you can drop the cache line, set it to invalid, and use it for loading new cache lines. So that's the other use of write-back. Yeah, so that is a rough idea of what might happen in there. Of course, you see that between all those states, there's a lot of state change. State transitions that can happen, and for the details of that I think my assistant is preparing a more detailed overview combined with an exercise, so that should appear in the next tutorial sheet. Also in the literature, also in the literature you will probably find a more detailed overview on what can actually happen. I think in that particular one you might have to read a little bit critically, because that is from reading on that, I think there's a few assumptions that go a little bit too far that the author does in this one. So read it with care. So there might be a few contradictions in there. We try to not run into those traps in the tutorial, but we see. So read it with an open mind, but don't take it down to every word, because I'm not so sure whether it's completely correct. But anyway, it gives you a pretty good idea of what happens in these systems. However, I think with just this excerpt over here, we have already all the important stuff.
Just out of curiosity, because for the embedded technology, you mentioned that you wait for the other processors, but what happens in a rest condition? So two processors issue invalidate, and basically one processor acts two times, and is there like a processor ID technology?
There is a linearization of the messages, so one of them comes first. Usually you shouldn't be able you implement your hardware in the sense that if there is already an invalidation request out, that there's no other one that will be issued until the responses are out there. So.
Acknowledge
Yeah.
Well, at some point, if there's more invalidations on that, then the old processor will also lose possession of its cache line, so it can't continue from that point on. It needs to request a new one. So, well, either the other one has then done its changes and can serve that request, or the main memory needs to answer for that. So in the end, if you use it in the context, it should not. It's sorted out. So I think for that we would need to design a particular example to see what actually happens in there. So we can do so, but I would not do that online, please. So we can do that maybe later or in the tutorial. It should usually it should work out in a way that no data is lost in that particular sense. But yeah. Yeah, that. Yeah, if that happened, then that can't happen in that sense, because if one tries to make its copy exclusive, then it's only considered to be exclusive if the other one has responded to that. And in responding, the other one drops possession of the cache line. So either one of them must have responded for the other one to continue, and the responded the responding one should have discarded its copy. So yeah, you know which processor sent it, and the processor itself, in sending its acknowledgement, also evicts the cache line. So there should never be a situation where two of them have think that they are the exclusive owners of a particular cache line. So usually can't happen. Either one has not answered yet, so he cannot continue, or the other one has answered and has evicted the cache line. No, it should come with a source. Yeah. Okay. Good. So, yeah. Let's exercise an example of that. So, there's. So there's two threads here that might look familiar. You might know them from the introductory slides. So there's code for thread A and code for thread B. We have labeled the instructions here in order to make it easier to reason about their behavior on the cache later on. So it's A for thread A, dot instruction 1, instruction 2, and so on. So the initial values we assume to be zero. Also, in order to reason a little bit about that, we suppose that A and B reside in different cache lines. That doesn't come naturally. The cache lines have a certain size, usually 64 bytes in our context. So it comes not naturally that A and B reside in different cache lines. But for our purposes, let's assume that they are, and you can force them to reside in different cache lines by padding with superfluous data between them. So that's what you can do in that case. For modeling the state of the cache lines for the variables A and B, we use the formalism over here with MX, EX, SX, and I, where X is the current value of the
of the address, and the latter is the state of the cache line. So let's have a look at how this works out. So we start in that case just randomly by with thread A and its first instruction. So this is well, starting from an empty cache. So the cache lines for the particular variables are not present yet or invalid conceptually. And in RAM, we have the initial values 0 and 0 for the variables. And, well, in order to process something, first of all, we need to obtain the cache line for the particular variable. So we need the cache line for variable A. Thus, we will observe read invalidate from CPU A. Why read invalidate? Well, we intend to write to that particular cache line. So we need so, well, since that is the first thing that we do, we can merge the two messages in one and issue this read invalidate. What will happen then is that well, invalidations are things that are answered by other processors. You have processor B there that doesn't have any information about A so far, so it will send an invalidate acknowledgement for cache line of A. So far, there's still no state change in any of those, and because we still miss the actual value of the cache line. So that is something that will be delivered by the main memory if none of the other processes is able to do so. This comes quite naturally since the main memory usually is a lot slower than the other caches in providing data. So there's at least one order of magnitude between them. So usually all the systems can just start looking up whether they have values for that, and usually other processors will raise the main memory to an answer in case they have something to answer. If not, then at some point the main memory will deliver the answer. And that it does here by giving the read response of A is 0. So thread A now can start doing its modifications. So in principle, it would, as soon as it obtains a read response, it will have exclusive an exclusive image of the main memory at that particular point, but it will immediately write into that without even waiting what the value in there is. So it doesn't really need to because it's just stored to A, so it will immediately write in there. So that's what's happening here. We will, with that, go into state modified with value 1. So that is the final state change after all these exchanged messages. And, well, with that, statement A1 is over. And, well, we can schedule another one. In this case, this will be probably B1. And, well, B1 will... well, B1 is interested in the value of B with a perspective of needing to read from B in order to decide whether the condition is fulfilled or not. So someone's stopwatch is going off here. Did I exceed any timer? No? Okay. So there's the need for reading B, so that's exactly what CPU B issues over here, since it has yet no information on the value of B. It's the cache line is considered invalid, so what it will issue is a read, not a read invalidate, because it doesn't need to write in there. Instead, it will just issue a normal read. And well, that is something that thread A will just not answer because it doesn't have any information about that. So after a little bit of time, our slow main memory will then decide to do something and deliver the read response for that with the actual value. So this will deliver B0 to thread B, which will then immediately note that down in its cache as exclusive value of B being 0. So transitions from I to E 0. With that, it can actually then interpret the value of B and decide what to do here, which will essentially be, well, looping once again. So B1 will once again be interested in the value of B, and, well, notices that there is already a version of B in there. It's exclusive, so it's considered to be the most recent one. And, well, you can use that for deciding the condition, still fulfilled, so it will loop again and do so over and over and over again until scheduling on the other processor will decide to continue with A2, for example. So in that case, what will happen is, well, we will write to B. So this only works if, well, writing to B means that, first of all, I need information about B. I don't have it yet, because it's considered to be invalid so far. So what happens is that there needs to be a read invalidate message. Why invalidate? Well, we immediately want to store value 1 in there, so that's what we do. We issue that coming from CPU A and concerning B. And in this case, there is already information about about variable B out there. It's stored for CPU B. So CPU B, coming from that particular state, will say, oh, I have information about that. It's also exclusive. So, well, happy times are over. Now I have to share my information. So it will answer with a read response, transitioning from exclusive knowledge about the variable to shared knowledge. The cache line has been duplicated to the other core. So both of them have the value of shared now. And now what else comes into play is that the original read request was also a combined one. It was a one with intent to write. So after answering the request, well, there's still the need to collect all the invalidate acknowledge messages from all the other peers. So there's just one to collect here from CPU B, and this will be delivered directly after the read response. So there's an invalidation acknowledgement, which will result in CPU B dropping information on the value of B, and instead giving CPU A the exclusive ownership on the cache line for B, and this will be immediately used for local computation of an update to this cache line, leading to this the exclusive ownership of that not remaining for long. Instead, will be exchanged for modified 1. With that, we have the execution of thread A terminated, but there's still thread B to check. So let's continue. We just copy the cache state from before, so it's modified 1 for all the cache lines in CPU A. CPU B is back to invalid for everything, and the RAM is still having outdated values for A and B. So now what happens is that thread B still needs to continue working. So at some point we will arrive at the condition once again. So for that,
Now, well, we can't locally satisfy the evaluation of B, so, well, in that case we'll have to ask the others for help. So that is a read access, no write access, so we will issue a read request from CPU B, which will, well, be on the bus, and turns out that CPU A has actual information about the about variable B, particularly it's in modified state over here. If it's modified, it's still exclusive, but that won't remain for long, since the other one needs a response to its read request. So what we will do is we will share our information with the other CPU, and well, we can only do so when we notify the main memory that there has some change in our values for the main memory. So what we will do is we will answer with a write back message transitioning to shared state on CPU A, and on receiving the write back we can install the cache line with value 1 in CPU B's B cache line, and also, well, the RAM will notice that there has been a write back message on the bus, so it will step in and also note down that there has been a change on or update on the cache line for B, and will somehow register that in its internals. So the RAM now also knows that B is 1. With that, B1 will have evaluated to false, and well, now for the first time we can execute B2, which is a check whether A1 is 1 now, and well, this will result in again a read and a write back, since it's basically the same situation. We have invalid here, modified here, so we go to shared, and inform the main memory with the write back. So that's how we end up with the case that although we replicated information in core 1's personal memory, core 2 will still know about what actually happened and will get a replica of this personal information and be able to still draw the right conclusions out of that. So we still know that A1 that A is 1. So yeah, there's I think the only thing over here is what would happen if we still if we restart thread A. Once again, I'm not particularly sure why it's there. I think it just is there for illustrating that it might have a different well, the messages that you could observe would be different if you start from a different initial state. So now we have the state S1 for all of the cache lines in comparison to invalid from before, and in the state of invalid we would have this read invalidate and invalidate acknowledgement. Here, in this context, you'd actually see a difference. There would not be a read necessary because the information is already present, but instead we would then continue with a simple invalidate. So what you should take away from that last line is the way that the communication on the bus plays out is strongly depending on the initial value of the cache, so on the machine state that you're in. So you might with the same code and the same control flow, you might actually observe completely different behavior. So, since that was rather tedious to track, well, we have had a different means of talking about events that happen in distributed systems, and this was introduced in the context of the happened before relation, and was called the happened before diagram, and that is what we can also use to make our life, well, probably more easy and more to render the processes that are run there more transparent to us.
So this makes the communications between the partners more explicit than before. What you do is you introduce a cache line for each of the processes that is in the system. So usually one processor or core executes a process, so it gets associated with one particular cache line that acts as the connection to the original program, thus gives us the program order of the occurring events. And what else is in there is that on the level that we are right now, we would differentiate between the different variables. Okay, you've seen that already on diagrams in the past, but you would also replicate them for each of the processes since they are represented in each process's cache. So in the cache of each process you keep local copies of A and B, and well, potentially there's also the main memory involved in this, and you would in this diagram this won't play a role, but in further diagrams that might, so you would in that case then add another line and label it with main memory or something. For us that's not happening here because I've designed my example here that we won't interact with main memory, but you have to introduce for each of the communication partners you have to introduce a particular line to represent. So the red dots in that are particular events that happen in there. So usually the instructions from the original programs have connecting events like start of the execution of that instruction and end of the execution of that instruction, and in between those two dots the instruction is considered to be blocking. So you can't continue to the next instruction if you haven't connected to the terminating event of that particular instruction. And each time that this crosses over to another process line, we consider also that with an event. For example, let's have a look at this one over here. First of all, we should also take care of, well, we have seen in the last slide that what happens is strongly depending on the actual initial state of the system, so we would should fill out the whole thing with its initial state. So A caches B0 as exclusive. Exclusive 0. B caches A as exclusive. Also 0. And, well, what about the other ones? Well, if the cache lines are exclusive, then there should not be any other replication going on. Instead, all other information that's out there should be that this is invalid. So, I for the other ones. Good. So, let's start talking about that. Here, this is the first chain of events that we will look at. So we start working on instruction set A to 1. So this first goes to check locally whether it can do something about that. We realize that the current state of the cache line is invalid, so it cannot really set the value in there. So what usually happens if cache line is invalid and we want to write in there, we issue read invalidate. That's what we find over here. So this will go out there and, well, in this case it will reach process B because B has information on A in exclusive state. So a read invalidate will be received by this one and answered with a read response transitioning to S0, communicating S0 over here and immediately invalidating after sending the invalidate acknowledgement, leading to this thing to, well, first turning to exclusive but essentially turning to modified because we immediately write in there. So it's modified one from that point on. And with that, execution of that instruction will terminate. So we will go on. And scheduling says that we continue with this one. So this is a check for whatever B evaluates to. So this is tried to be resolved locally. But we realize, the cache line is invalid so far, so we need to issue a read request, reaching, the other processor, because it has information about B. So this reaches over here and will be answered with a read response, moving to shared. And with shared 0, we can answer our query over here, terminating that thing, and then we have another go at the loop with another evaluation of the condition. And this time, by checking our local cache, we see, we already have a value present over here, so we don't need to communicate any further. Instead, we can just interpret whatever we find there and execute this command. So this can be locally answered. Then let's continue on with B1. B1 has needs to be executed, so it will first consider its local copy in B, which is shared 0. Shared 0 in validate, of course, will consider its local copy there. It's shared, but since we need to write in there, we want to invalidate the cache line for the other one. So that's what we do with the message over here, which will reach the processor B, and it has a shared version of that. After invalidate and its acknowledgement, it won't have any more, so it goes to invalid. And as soon as this is perceived by processor A, this will go to first of all exclusive, but finally then in modified one, and terminate. So with that, there's only instructions on the B side left, so we need to check the condition locally. The cache line is unluckily invalid, so we need to read from over there. This is modified, so we usually will answer with a write back and set to shared one afterwards. So that's communicated over here, and with that the instruction can terminate, and the next one can be interpreted hitting invalid from over here once again. So it goes out and issues a read request, which will be answered over here, dropping exclusive state or modified state to shared one, communicating that with a write back such that the main memory will also be notified with S1, and with that we can terminate the interpretation of that thing. So that's now a way to visualize and work with caches, which is probably a lot more convenient than the one before. So that is the thing that we will cling to in future. So, also what you can note over here is that there are certain executions that can be fulfilled locally, which is the whole purpose of having these local copies in your memory. As long as there's no actual competition on certain addresses, this works fine and can speed up your computation a lot, because there's no need to communicate with other processes, but all your needs can be fulfilled from local cache. So you would like to have this situation as often as possible. So all in all, what this is about is that, with this messy cache coherence protocol, the goal is to establish sequential consistency, in the sense that although you replicate data, your view on the data will never be outdated, such that you run into a violation of sequential consistency, without sequential consistency is a nice property that you want to have, because that is what you consider to be a well-behaved program. When your computer guarantees sequential consistency, you can assume that, yes. If it can. It usually doesn't. But, yeah. Yeah, so from a theoretical point of view, as long as you're just considering simple caches, you can implement that in hardware such that it appears as if it would be sequential consistent and behave like that, and you never get any violations. The problem is in the next steps when you drop further constraints on your system that this won't be the case anymore. But yeah, that's how reality is. Okay, good. So for programming, that's a nice thing, because sequential consistency is usually considered to be a criterion for correctness of programs. So that's a good thing. There's also a nice thing, because with the MESI protocol, we have an actual way of implementing hierarchies of memory of different speed and still get some kind of consistent view on the memory. So that's also a good thing. We can optimize for speed with that thing. With the means of the happened before diagram, we can also when we fix a certain path through the threads, we can illustrate what can happen in these situations quite good with the means of the happened before diagram. Yeah, so so far so good. The ugly reality is that if you just work with plain caches and a MESI protocol, you will only get so far in terms of speed. Usually, there's a tendency from hardware manufacturers to lure you into even more speedy computations by accepting to drop constraints on correctness of programming of programs, and this is what you see in this development of going from quite strong consistency models to weaker and weaker memory models. And one step in that direction is the introduction of so-called store buffers, which will enable to delay the actual commitment of stores to the main memory to some later point, and your program to continue working locally in your algorithm. And yeah, well, of course, this seems like a good idea, since this makes a lot of communication overhead look like this is not actually happening, so you can speed up your computation. However, this has certain consequences on execution. So this comes under the topic of out-of-order execution. So the motivation for that was that, looking back at the example that we had over here, is our problem was that if as soon as we start writing on shared variables, we always have to wait for these things like combinations of read response and invalidate acknowledgements, or in a case that we already have possession of the cache line to for the invalidate acknowledgements to arrive. This is not so much of a problem if you only have two partners in communication, but with a tendency of stuffing more and more and more cores in your computer, you have to account for, in the worst scenario, something like what is currently in there, 8 cores in a processor with hyper-threading 16. for a normal desktop, yeah. For the server processors. Or even more in these reduced functionality things, like so. Yeah, so there's a lot of processes out there. However, I think in the more advanced server designs, you usually won't have one-to-n communication anymore in that sense, but you have some kind of hierarchical systems that distribute among themselves. Anyway, doesn't matter too much because with 16 partners already for collecting invalid data acknowledgements, you get a lot of traffic on your bus, which is in that time blocked for anything else. So that's clearly a thing that can turn out to be a performance problem. So writes will stall you a lot of time. So the idea would be, well, since in our case we don't really do too much apart from writing, why not continue anyway? Because, well, at some point this will be done, but I can continue my work to work on something completely different because I don't really depend on my update to this memory cell to be present directly after the assumed termination of my instruction. So the idea would be, how can we enable a processor to continue working after having committed a store? And well, there's ideas for that, and that is particularly the concept of store buffers, and that is a thing that has been introduced well quite a while ago. I think the Spark architecture was quite reminiscent of that. So this was also one of the architectures that did a very good job in specifying what the hardware actually really does in terms of giving a specification of the memory model that it is actually offering. So in the context of the Spark architecture, what we're talking about here is the so-called total store ordering as a name of a memory model. So TSO is the keyword in that sense. And since, I think it was 82 or something, since that it has been adopted by a lot of other architectures. So I think the current x86 instruction set for large parts also also keeps to total store ordering. I think there's a few fractions of instructions from this SSE thing that actually break with total store ordering, but yeah, it's like the usual mess with Intel architectures. But in any way, the TSO thing is quite widely accepted in the community. So that is something that if you talk about memory models, you will encounter in a lot of locations, particularly also in x86, which will probably power a lot of your devices that I see around there. Good. So the idea is was to introduce an optimization, an hardware optimization, which would break with sequential consistency in order to enable optimizations of memory accesses. And the general gist was to continue execution after a cache missing write operation. And the idea how to achieve that was to, instead of having direct communication between a CPU and its cache, you would introduce a new feature in this pipeline called store buffer, and store buffer would be there for in case that a cache line is not present yet in the cache. So instead of waiting for the cache line to arrive at some point, what you would do is you would put the update to the address in the store buffer and continue writing. So store buffer would trigger that the event has terminated in the original program, so it can continue, and it would keep the update to the address in its internal buffer, while also triggering that the cache fetches the line from the memory with some kind of read request, read invalidate probably, and only when the cache line finally arrives in the cache, the store will actually be applied to the now arriving cache line. So this store buffer already carries in its name the characteristics of being a buffer or a queue in that sense. This is now sounds trivial, but it's not always granted in all of the systems that are out there that this entity between the CPU and the cache is actually acting as a buffer. There's also ideas out there which don't act in a first-in, first-out way. For example, there's also modes in the same document as the TSO, where you can configure your Spark to act in PSO, which is the partial store order, which actually violates the assumption that this is an actual buffer over here, and correct execution of programs gets a lot harder with that then. So anyway, if you simply implement the whole thing as a store buffer without any other precautions, would run into problems with the sense of, well, your program order will dictate a certain order between the memory accesses in there. For example, that if you issue a store to some address at some point, and later on being defined by program order, issue a load to that address, that you will get the value that you have stored in the latest store. And if you put it in the store buffer instead, well, you will get some answer of some value, of course. There's no guarantee that this is actually already updated with the value that went into the store buffer. So of course you will not want to have such a, well, I say of course, but in our case we don't want to have this kind of behavior here. So what's usually done is that there's a snooping mechanism on the connection to the actual cache that pays attention to whether an address that is kept in the store buffer for future application to the cache line. Well, if such an address is queried on the way from CPU to cache, then the store buffer will step in and answer with the more recent value. So that you at least on a per CPU level get some kind of consistency in the ordering between stores and loads. So don't confuse that with a sequential consistency in the global system. That is not given by this snooping thing. So this is meant on a per CPU level. So this just repairs the cases where you might not see the most recent store to a particular address. So, apart from this very machine model centric specification of the memory ordering for Spark, if we look into appendix of the specification, we will see that there's also quite precise specification of what the memory model is all about in terms of a formal specification. So it's a little bit longer than the one that you see over here, because it also talks about other things like flush instructions and atomic instructions, which for simplicity I have left out so far because we haven't introduced these kinds of instructions so far, but they transparently can be integrated in the rule set that we see over here. So to really nail it down, what the TSO is all about, because for sequential consistency we had a quite precise description. Let's have a look at what we find there. So a total store order has several aspects that need to be fulfilled over there. So first of all, there's the aspect of the store ordering with respect to the global memory order. So all the events that are considered globally visible is total, meaning that whenever I talk about any addresses A and B and any CPU I and J that I might encounter in my program execution, that whenever there is a store happening on a CPU I to address A and on CPU J on address B, so on possibly all CPUs and all addresses, whenever there is a store happening, then I will have an order between those two stores, and it will be either that the either way around. So can be either that the store from I is in front or the store from J is in front, but one of them will be guaranteed to be there. So the in the memory order, we have a total order on all the stores embedded. So that is what is said over there. And this is the base of all the memory model of the total store ordering. So that's the fundamental thing in there. There's also other things relating the way that program order is relating the program order to the memory order, particularly for the stores. So if stores are in program order, expressed by this particular ordering operator, and it doesn't matter which address the stores are going to. However, since they're in program order, they are usually interpreted on the same CPU, thus the same index for the CPU ID. So if they appear in program order, thus the way that you want them to be executed, this will also be reflected in the global memory order. So they appear in the same order in the memory order as they appear in the program order. Next thing is about the ways that loads are arranged in terms of order in the program order and the memory order. So if a load appears in front of any old other operation in your program order, once again, program order means that you execute it on the same CPU. Doesn't matter which address this is associated with, but if this load event is associated to be preceding some other operation in program order, then this will also be reflected in the memory order. So loads will never be able to kind of overtake other operations in terms of their way from program order to memory order. And the final point now is about talking about the actual values that are associated with each of these events. So this is kind of the giving the bridge to the semantics of programs. So the value that is associated with some load executed from a processor I when loading from address A is always associated with a store. its value. So there needs to be either the initial value or the or some store happening before the load happens. And usually what you would assume is that you will have some notion of latest occurred store that you want your load to be associated with in terms of value. I think that is something that's quite desirable. Okay? So that's what's trying to be established over here. So be associated with a particular store. It doesn't necessarily need to be a store that was executed on the same machine as the load. Of course, you might have concurrent accesses to variables, and you still want to observe the values that others have written. So it needs to be not necessarily the same CPU that issued this store. So what is the store now about? So this What is the store? The store is considered. Well, there's choice for whatever the store, there are candidates for the store that can be associated with a load. And which are the candidates? Well, usually you can have stores that are ordered in memory order and have occurred before the particular load. They don't necessarily need to be from the same machine, but my memory order has nailed down some kind of order on these events. And if if there's a store given to us by the memory order to have happened before the load, then it's considered to be a candidate for association with the load. Of course, this will yield the complete history of all stores that have happened before. In order to sort out what the most recent one is, what we do is we build or we express it with the maximum with respect to program order. Okay, so this gives us the latest store in terms of program order that has happened before the load. But that's not all. What we get also is this part over here. This takes into account other stores. These stores are ones that are associated with the load in terms of program order. So this is this green less than equal symbol over here. And note that they need to be executed with the same CPU, of course, since they are related in program order. And you gather all those that are ordered to have occurred, have happened before the load. And since they are in the same maximum function, you will take the most recent one with respect to the program order. You might now ask, does that actually make a difference whether I take the ones from the program order or the ones from the memory order? I mean, in the end, we will compare them with program order anyway. Well, it actually does, because remember, stores have not been prohibited from being able to overtake loads on the way to the actual memory order. So including these locally happening before stores into this clause over here might give us stores that have not been expressed by the relation over here, because they would in principle have been sorted out later on. When on their way down to the program order, Why is that? Well, the intention of that is, of course, that you have something like a store buffer. So locally, they appear to have happened in programming in program order before the load, but they have been delayed by the store buffer on the way to the global memory order. So in the global memory order, they might occur a lot later on. Thus, have not been covered yet in this clause. So this combination here gives you the desired property that you're after. So this gives you... Oh, sorry. So this part... No. This gives you the program order specific predecessors of your load. This gives you the global memory order specific predecessors of your load, and both of them combined give you all possible candidates that you might want to consider for associating with your load. Yes? Yes. Oh, yeah, no. This is really meant to be the program order. Sorry. Got you there. Yeah. So this is meant to be the memory order. And, yeah. Yes, please. Yeah, so you can only answer that, well, in a mathematical sense, at some point there will be an ordering between all occurred stores. So this is what is given to us by this one over here, so you can always decide. So this definition doesn't care about time or anything. The whole execution of the complete program is already happened, and this definition just tells us whether this execution is really one that is allowed to happen with respect to this memory model or not. And with the whole execution already being rolled out, you can always decide. Okay, so... with that specification in mind, we can now particularly pinpoint what is kind of the loophole that the memory model has opened up for optimization. Particularly, one property is not guaranteed, and this came to attention when you compare the properties from there and there, for example. So they are somewhat different, and you might wonder why they were necessary to be different. And particularly what is not guaranteed is that if a program order says that a store happens before a load, then it also is reflected in the memory order. So on the way from program order to memory order, a store might overtake a load. And... be considered to be happening much later on. So, this is exactly what the store buffer is giving us. And well, considering that it's not really completely straightforward to connect the two models with each other, although they appeared in the same specification, it has, I think, needed 15 years or something for someone to actually come up with a paper that proves that both of the models are actually the same. But turns out that TSO in its formal specification is the same as in its machine model specification. So they both are actually the same specification. So what happens now in our examples when we introduce things like store buffers? So let's have a look at our old example of A1, B1 and the while loop. And, well, yeah, for initialization. Say A has S 0, B E 0, A S 0, B invalid, and the store buffer is, for our purposes, empty in the beginning, or contains things that don't interest us. So, what happens? For writing something like A is 1, we consider, well, not completely happy with... depends on the amount of detail that you put into these modelings with these things. In that, in our case, I would say, well, it's roughly okay what we see here, because it says that the store that's imminent to happen for A goes into the store buffer, but you would usually have to consider the cache line to be somehow part of the whole communication. With the store buffer be sitting in front of the cache line, you could argue that, well, the store buffer is always queried first, and this then clarifies with the cache whether a cache line is present or not. So usually I would consider that there's also another type of communication going on between the actual cache line, because it needs to clarify whether the cache needs to read its cache line from somewhere else, something. In our case, the store buffer has realized that we have a cache line over here, but it's shared. So there's usually some communication to be done. So what will happen is it will enter the store to happen into the store buffer and terminate immediately. And at some point, whenever it feels like it, the store buffer will be applied to the cache line and also execute its necessary communications, like the invalidation and stuff. But there's actually no real guarantee that this will happen immediately. So in our case, we can still continue work. For example, in our case, directly continue with setting B to 1. This will, in principle, also go to the way through the store buffer. And the store buffer would check that that the cache line for B is exclusive. In that case, store buffer doesn't need to do any buffering at all, but can immediately execute the change over here. So it will go to modified 1. So the store buffer will not have to be modified at all, and the whole thing can terminate, and thread A is then already completely done. And on the other side, what can happen with the other process is that at some point the thread will start and will first of all try to evaluate its condition by going to the cache line for B, reading from that, and realizing that it is not present yet, so it has an invalid state for the address of B. So it will decide to issue a read request, which will reach its peer, which will then communicate the answer with a write back and go to shared state, giving S1 back as read response, so that this instruction can terminate and will realize that the loop condition is now false. So it will continue with its assertion, and here what it will do is it will go to its cache line, see, well, there's shared state 0 in there, so I can directly answer my my test and realize, oh bugger, my my assertion is now not fulfilled. So that is the execution that you might have been waiting for if you have paid attention in the introductory slide. I said that, well, not I, but it was said that the assertion here might actually fail and crash the program, and that's how it actually works. So in a, if your initial state and your particular scheduling of whenever buffer is emptying and all kicks in with the right sequence, then you might observe that this assertion is not actually really fulfilled. So it's not a guarantee, but there are executions that that will fail this assertion, although you would not initially expect that to be. And that is because modern architectures like x86 have actually store buffers and are not sequentially consistent. So what can you do in that case? Well, you will usually have to make sure yourself that the execution becomes sequentially consistent, and the way that you do that is by the use of a so-called write barrier. So write barrier is an instruction that can be inserted in the instruction flow of your program, and what it does is semantically it will go to the store buffer and will mark off all the currently contained store operations and block execution of this barrier instruction until all the stores that are marked in the buffer have completed. Well, it does not block the instruction itself, but as soon as the next store operation is tried to be issued, then the block actually happens. So yeah, that's one particular way of doing it, still permitting for a little bit of progress in the program, but conceptually it's, well, at some point the program blocks until all the stores that have happened so far are carried out in the cache. And yeah, that's what this SFENS instruction is all about. It gives you a so-called write barrier, and yeah, with that you can counteract the effects of store buffer so far as, well, if you introduce write barriers after each of the writes that happens in your program, you will actually end up with a completely sequentially consistent program. However, well, since you will always insist on the store buffer being emptied before the next store can actually happen, well, that's just like no store buffer would be applied at all. So yeah, in terms of speed gain that is given to you by this particular memory model, you won't profit at all. So yeah, the gist of that is write barriers are somehow costly and you would like to use them only when necessary. In our model, what you would do in order to enforce that the write to A becomes visible before the write to B is, you would add such an S-fence in there, which is the write barrier for the x86 architecture, and this would then lead to the store buffer being emptied before the execution of store to B can actually happen, and with that you will never come to a situation where you can find the updated value in B1 via this communication and then still have an old value of A1 in there, because, well, emptying the store buffer with an S-fence would lead to an actual invalidation to be communicated. So that's how you patch this whole thing. this whole system can continue with a few other optimizations, for example, like invalidate queues, but I think since we have exceeded our time for today, I would say we continue next time. Thank you for your attention, and I hope you learned something today. Have a nice day.